very pleased to be welcoming back Neil Ottman to Mind in Mind. He's written a thought piece for us. For those of you who might not have come across Neil before, Neil is a child, adolescent and adult psychotherapist. He's based at the William Allison White Institute in New York. And the reason why you've written this thought piece for us and doing this little interview with me, Neil, is because you've had some really direct experience of living in an area where there's been an awful lot of COVID. And you've been thinking about its effect on children in particular, haven't you?
Yes, I've been thinking about it. I've been immersed in it, completely immersed, having a six-year-old myself and seeing children in New York. But then also having the experience of my son's school and how they're handling it. And hearing about other schools from my patients, from my child patients, from their parents, and from other parents who talk about what's going on in their schools. And the schools are faced with this problem of whether to open, whether to have remote learning, what it's like for children at different ages. I've had a chance to observe this directly, what it's like for children of different ages to be learning remotely, to be in school, to have the school open and close. And there are so many things happening in the lives of children that are incomprehensible, not only to them, but to us, the parents and the teachers and the administrators of the school. And having to pivot continuously in the basic framework of education, and at the same time try to help the children feel that there's some kind of stability in their lives, some kind of comprehensibility to it, when we ourselves are seriously challenged to find that kind of stability and framework for our own lives. Mm-hmm. And of course, this varies a lot because some parents are working from home more or less without interruption and able to support their families and provide that kind of stability for their children. Whereas other parents have lost their jobs suddenly, there are financial crises, the schools have closed and opened and closed and opened. And so the whole environment for children is topsy-turvy. And how do we help them with that? And that's what I've been thinking about.
I'm interested because I think this is a dilemma for an awful lot of parents around the world, really. It's not just in the UK, which is one of the hotspots in Europe at the moment, but all over Europe, in America, and elsewhere in the world where the pandemic has been hitting quite hard. What lessons are you thinking that we should be learning from this, and how can we be helping children?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing that I'll start with is that when my older children were in school, they were in a progressive school, what's called progressive education. I think it's the same in the UK, the same terminology. And so progressive education, the way I understand it, means that the focus is on children exploring their world and learning because they're interested in the worlds that they live in and the people and the things that people do. And so rather than teaching children rote by rote, for example, how to read, how to do mathematics, children learn it almost incidentally in the course of exploring their worlds. They learn how to read because they want to know about things. And so they read in order to learn. They don't learn in order to read. And that's different from the way most traditional schools operate. So I had a chance to see my older children learning in that progressive model some years ago. And after a number of false starts with education for my six-year-old, we finally found a progressive school in a different city and actually moved, partly because of the pandemic, but partly in order to put him in a school that still had faith in that sort of progressive vision of how children learn. So one thing that I've been thinking about a lot, which was the basis for this thought piece, was that if children are learning by building on the curiosity about the worlds that they live in, what is the implication for their world being suddenly topsy-turvy and not only confusing to them, but confusing to the adults who are supposed to be shepherding them through the process of learning about their world when the adults themselves are profoundly confused and disoriented? So after living through this for a few months, it occurred to me that as a general principle, we should be thinking about studying pandemics and studying other times in history when people were thrown into this kind of confusion. And if we're not doing that, or let me put it this way, that the progressive education vision of learning about your world shouldn't stop at the point where something happens that's profoundly disorienting, even though we don't know how to do it. But there again, that's exploring together with children and with families how to pivot, how to reorient yourself, and how other people have done that throughout history. History is full of these events. There have been pandemics all along. There have been wars. There have been all kinds of events that throw everything up in the air in a very confusing way. And so even though we can't suddenly create new curriculum, especially when we don't really know what we're talking about, at least we can start to think about that. And so that's where this thought piece came from.
Mm. Yeah, and I think you do that very well. And the other thing which I think is really interesting in the thought piece is when you talk about anxiety, which of course in psychoanalytic psychotherapy, this is a very big part of it in as much as that being able to be alongside anxiety, being alongside difficult feelings.
Yes.
As a therapist, but I suppose really we're talking about as parents here as well.
Yeah, right. So another thing that I've been thinking about a lot is the relationship between psychoanalysis and education. Progressive education really grows out of a psychoanalytic vision. And I think the part of psychoanalysis that John Dewey and others appropriated for the educational process has to do with the value of coming to understanding on one's own in a way. That is, rather than being given by the adults an understanding or information about the world and about people, the children's sort of natural curiosity will propel them to learn. And so the important principle, I think, in both psychoanalysis and progressive education is to encourage the child's natural desire to learn about reality. And the place where that interfaces with psychoanalysis, I think, has to do with the evolution that Ferenczi initiated, where his point about psychoanalysis is that children get mystified by their parents in situations of abuse and trauma, where unthinkable things are happening in the child's lives and in the family. The children come to feel that they're not supposed to know what they know, and a blanket of denial gets put over the child's experience. And so children very quickly learn about what they're supposed to know and what they're not supposed to know. And this gave rise in the United States, I think, to Sullivan's theory, which is now given birth to interpersonal psychoanalysis and relational psychoanalysis, which is about how the grown-up patient shows evidence of having learned what they're not supposed to be thinking about, what they're not supposed to know. And so Sullivan's emphasis in his version of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis was exploring blind spots and avoidances. And that's how that's how anxiety manifests itself, through blind spots. And so Sullivan's way of exploring things was through what he called a detailed inquiry, asking questions about the things that the patient evidently doesn't want to think about. And so this also can be seen, it may seem to go against the way we usually divide up psychoanalytic schools, but this is also there in Melanie Klein. That Melanie Klein was, and then later Bion, was very much about taking account of reality, about looking into dark and scary places in the mind, and developing a tolerance for what Bion came to call containment of those scary things. So I think this plays itself out in terms of how I've come to think about what children and all of us need at this pandemic moment.
Thanks for that, Neil. I think that was such an interesting way of pulling these things together and holding it theoretically, but actually putting it how we do this in practice. So it's a process of containment and going to the difficult places that we need to go to with our children. Because I know that you've talked about, you know, even, you know, to sort of question their thinking about racism, to question their thinking about poverty. These are really difficult areas, aren't they, to explore with adults. But with children, this is something that you're saying we really need to do that with them and use this as an opportunity to go to those dark and scary places and to be able to think about it with them. Obviously not in a way to scare them too, but to actually be able to make sense of it, to digest some of it.
That caveat that you put in just now about not to scare them or not to scare them unduly is a very tricky thing to be thinking about. And I think that there's a big blind spot in many societies about protecting children from getting overly disturbed or scared on one hand, and on the other hand, denying that they're exposed to those things all the time. And that the challenge really is to know how to talk with children about things. So for example, I'm aware that the same parents who worry about what their children might see on the street, let's say homeless people, they also don't take in the fact that as their children learn to read and they pass newsstands all the time, they see headlines about horrific things, including photographs, all the time. They see them in the magazines and the newspapers and in their own homes. So what do we think is going on that children don't know about these things already? Another thing that strikes me is that when you walk into a church, the first thing you see is Jesus on the cross. I mean, how many questions does that raise for everyone? And how many people talk about what that story really is and what happened to Jesus? And there he is, like front and center all the time. So when we worry a lot about scaring children, we should think about what already would scare them if they stopped and thought about what they're seeing, or what we would think if we thought about what we're exposing children to without thinking about it. See, and that's where Ferenczi comes in. children learn what they're not supposed to know that they know. And that applies to adults and to children. So that's a big question, I think, not only for analysts, but also for every educator and every parent. How do people come to be able to pass homeless people in the street and not notice them? And that happens with everyone. That happens with adults. It happens with children. So adults, I can kind of, being an adult myself, I can kind of understand that you are, it's daunting to think about who is that person and how did they come to be that way and what is their experience living on the street like that? So not being prepared to go into that place, people just walk by, almost everyone. But children is a different story. I mean, why would children pass homeless people without looking, without a question? And of course, some children do ask questions and some children pick up on opportunities to, I don't know, bring them a sandwich or something like that. Rarely will a child try to talk to a homeless person. Now, how do they learn that? How do they learn that this, which in New York anyway, was everywhere, like in Manhattan especially, you couldn't go outside without seeing homeless people. And it's getting to be that way now as well. How do children learn? Because this has to be learned, I would think, that children are curious about everything. How is it that they're not curious about homeless people? So I don't have the answer to that, except that somehow, by some process, the adult's anxiety and the adult's self-created blind spot and the norms among adults are transmitted to the children. This is something that is not to be thought about. And that's just one example.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that blind spot that we have about lots of things in society that make us feel uncomfortable. Maybe COVID, and we talked about it a lot, especially during the first wave of the pandemic, that how, you know, we were going to shift as a society, how we were going to change. But certainly for some things, our eyes have been open more, haven't they, in terms of Black Lives Matter movement, racial inequalities. I think now people are starting to see economic inequality more, perhaps, than we did, say, a year ago. Our blind spots are sort of perhaps, you know, getting a little bit more vision now. We're sort of seeing things a little bit more. Our eyes have been opened.
Yes, I think that's right. There have been police killings of Black people continuously. I mean, that's nothing new. So I think you're raising the question of whether the killing of George Floyd at that particular time in the middle of the pandemic, white people opened their eyes and saw that, in part because their eyes were already starting to open because of a number of things, but in particular the inequalities and injustices in society that the pandemic exposed. I think the other thing that I was referring to that slipped my mind was about racial inequality, which is another thing which is right in front of our noses all the time and right in front of children's noses all the time, and yet in many cases not thought about. It reminds me with one of my older daughters that at some point, as part of some project that I was doing, I was asking children how they first learned about their own racial identity. What was the memory that they had when it first dawned on them that they had a racial and ethnic identity? And so I was interviewing my daughter. She was about 12 years old at that time. And I asked her about race. And she said, well, in my school, everybody's the same. And so I pushed on that point a little bit. And I said, well, there's this Black girl in your class, do you feel like you don't notice the difference, the racial difference? And she said, no. And I said, well, she comes to your neighborhood from her neighborhood to go to school, right? Have you been to her neighborhood? And it was suddenly like a light bulb went off in her mind. And she said, in effect, oh my goodness, I'd never realized that. So there's the process of not realizing that, like, where did that girl live? And how, what did she have to go through to come to school? And what was it like for her to go into a neighborhood that was 90% white people as a Black girl? Did she notice that? What was that like for her? Did my daughter ever think about what it was like for her classmate to do that? All of these things. And, you know, she was living in our family, a enlightened family. And even so, it was like a revelation to her to realize these very obvious things. So in the wake of the George Floyd, the Black Lives Matter, all of that, my son's school has Black Lives Matter pasted all over the school. So kids are starting to think about things that they're not used to thinking about. And I say starting, because I think the real question is going to be, is this something you pay lip service to when you think about and you make a show of thinking about in order to be in the subculture that is virtuous, maybe considered virtuous in her world, and drop it, leave it at that? Or is this something that you then think, well, what's the next step? What can be done about this? If I keep thinking about this, then I'm going to have to start thinking about myself, my own life, my family, how to respond to inequality, especially in view of the fact that, speaking for myself as an upper middle class white person, that the obvious thing that presents itself is perhaps our way of life would have to change too. It's not just that we are concerned about those people who are materially disadvantaged, but that those of us who have a lot might have to think about how would our lives change. And I think for a lot of people, that's where the curtain comes down and the thinking stops.
So that's an interesting question to raise with your children, isn't it, Neil? With all our children, I mean, you know, so, okay, you want things to be more equal. Are you happy to move to a smaller house for mummy and daddy to have less income? You know, these questions, they're really interesting things to talk about with our children. And as you say, to use this very difficult situation that we're all in to go to some darker places, but perhaps for all of us to reach a bit deeper into ourselves, and for our children to develop as well a sort of an emotional and cognitive depth, the consequence of having these conversations. Thank you very much for your time, Neil. I've really enjoyed talking with you again, and wishing you and your family healthy and happy months ahead, whilst we're all sort of trying to get through this pandemic.
Yes, thank you, Jane, and same to you.